a young man originally from the then Rhodesia, today one of the most influential people in South African wine. An all-round gentleman with a naughty sense of humor, I meet up with Dave Hughes at the Devon Valley Hotel, where he's a much-loved regular. In samenwerking met Wineland Media, deel van die Winpro familie. Ach, Dave, what an honor to be here with you at this beautiful setting and hotel that you know so well, and they know you so well here.
That's a nice place. Oh, I've known this hotel long before the owners got involved with the place. It used to be a South African Breweries Hotel, and when they were selling all their hotels, a family called Hofmeyr bought it, and over there was a bar, and his name was Paul, and it was known as Paul's Pub. And before I even came to live in South Africa, I used to stay here when Farmers Winery brought me down. I would stay here and do all the Farmers Winery stuff, but from here.
Yeah.
And so I've known it a long time, man. So.
But Dampy Bailey also used to stay here. I think that's how you guys came to know each other. And also where you guys started the swine wine, the wine swines.
Wine swine.
You started that here.
Yeah. Dampy. Yeah. yeah. Mr. Bailey. But, you know, he's remarkable in that he looks so young, but he actually came out at the same time as Van Riebeek.
I think that's an internal joke between the two of you, because I distinctly remember the story that told at your 80th birthday, that he told. I had a bit of a chat with him, and there's the whole story of your name and this David de Groot and Dave Huge. But we'll get to that story a bit later. But Dave, sitting here today, did you think as a young man coming from the then Rhodesia that you would be one of the biggest names and most respected names in South African wine?
No, never. No, it didn't cross my mind. You know, when I left school, I joined what was in those days very non-new, was called the Native Department. And I joined that because they stationed people out in the bush. So my very first job at 16 years of age, I was given a Land Rover and a house. So I had a house all to myself and in the bush, right down in the Sabi Valley, and, you know, young man's best dream.
Yeah.
It was unreal. So no, I never ever thought of, and I only ever got into the booze business by default. I came a time in my life when I didn't have a job, and my dad said, you must go and get a job. And I got a job in the, the laboratory of a distillery in Umtali, where I grew up. And that led into, first with spirits, and then eventually the breweries bought us out, and the breweries owned Stellenbosch Farmers Winery, and then they used to bring me down to South Africa once a year for the vintage. So that's basically how I got into wine.
I think it was your first job was actually in Johannesburg, if I remember correctly.
In South Africa.
Yes, in South Africa, yeah.
Not even as posh as Joburg, it was Germiston.
Jammer Germiston. But tell us about that first couple of years, those years where you started finding your feet in the industry.
Well, I'd come down here for the vintage over 5 or 6 years or so. So I already knew what was going on and who was who. And so when I got the breweries transferred me to Germiston, and we started doing stuff. In those days, we didn't bottle anything outside the Cape. So we started to bottle wines, like the big selling wines like Lieberstein and Zonheim, in other places, and one of them was Germiston. So I got into this wine business through that. And then my then boss, a guy called Ted Seals at the brewery, he liked juniper berries for smoking his fish. And we made gin and had juniper berries.
That sounds beautiful. Sounds lovely.
And he and I got to be good friends. And one day he said to me something about you need to do this or do that to further your career. And I got more into the management rather than making of the stuff. And so it was actually a brewer who got me into making wine. Yeah. And life takes different turns and whatever. And I eventually came to the Cape, and my wife at the time didn't actually like the Cape.
How could she?
And she had lived in what's now KwaZulu for a while, and she wanted to go back to KwaZulu. And so eventually we parted company, and for a long time we lived apart. She lived there and I lived here. And eventually my daughter said, you know, this is stupid. Either get divorced and let mom go away and you can do your thing. And so it was never, we didn't set out to separate. It was just that after 10 years of her living there and me living here, we decided to make the break. And and eventually I met this lady, Lorna, and I never ever had the intention of getting married again. Then I met this wild, wild woman. She flew aeroplanes and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, so that's...
She's also in the wine industry, Lorna?
Yeah, she was for a long time. She grew grapes and made wine. But in the last 10 or more years, she's devoted her life to looking after animals. She runs the animal welfare in Stellenbosch.
And you told me if someone looks after animals, they're automatically a good person.
I think so.
Right.
And that's why she looks after me. She, I don't know where my collar is.
Different kind of animal she's dealing with there, Dave. But if we look at years ago, so you said to further your career, you used those words. At what point did career become a passion, or did you early on realize that you had a passion for the wine industry and for the spirits industry, of course?
Well, once I got to Germiston, I realized that there was a lot more to do. And you know, I was very lucky that as a youngster, my boss sent me to Europe to go and learn about distilling. So I went to Cognac and Armagnac and places like that, and London for gin. So at a very early stage, I got overseas experience. And then when I came to the South Africa, in the Cape in particular, I discovered that most of the people in the distilling side really didn't have that much knowledge. And so it was easy to be quite knowledgeable amongst those guys. They all knew about wine, but when it came to spirits, you know, I suddenly was like the expert amongst a whole lot of people who just didn't know about it. And that's how I really got to know Dampy, because Dampy was chosen to go and work in the United States. And he came back also with his eyes wide open, and he'd learned a hell of a lot while he was there. And then he went back after doing his first degree. He came back and he went back to do an MBA. And when he first came back, he bought a Mustang car with him. And the second time, he bought a Mustang woman.
Sure, nice.
And he and I shared rooms at the Grand Hotel. He's just been a very, very good friend. So, a good guy.
He also says you're a good guy. So there's a lot of good guys in this business. He just said you are just a wonderful person, and what you've done for the industry is just it's difficult to put into words how important your role has been in the industry. How do you feel about that? Because it's always a very strange feeling having someone else say that you are a living legend. I know the word gets thrown around quite easily in the world, but that's how people really view you and the contribution you've made.
Well, you know, I personally don't see that happening. But when my daughter spent a couple of weeks with us recently, and she looked at my wall and just said, all these certificates and everything, and she said, just look at those. That proves that you have actually contributed. You wouldn't have those if you... And so I guess other people see things that you don't actually think about. But it's happening all the time. And it wasn't just a job. It was something I just was passionate about and did.
So we'll get to the writing and the... Let's just call you actually a wine and spirits historian to a certain extent, and the research that you've done in the past. I'd like to know when the writing started, because that's a whole different world of work. It's a whole different thing to do than being a super taster, which we'll also talk about next. But let's talk firstly then about the Cape Wine Academy that you started, if I remember, with Phyllis Hans, correct? And that was 1979. I was a full year old then. So how did that idea come to be?
It actually wasn't my idea. There was a guy in charge of Farmers Winery at that time was a guy called Ronnie Milk. And Ronnie was a visionary. Ronnie could see things that we never used to see. And when I started working with him, he said, I want to start a wine school that the ordinary man in the street can learn more about wine. And he said, you know, you must do it. And so he gave me a budget and we started the Cape Wine Academy. And then I needed somebody to run it, and Phyllis Hans was running a wine school at Landsrack Hotel. And I asked her if she would come along, and she did. And she made the Cape Wine Academy, and it just grew and grew. But it wasn't my idea. I was just given it to run. Yeah. And it was actually Ronnie Milk who had the idea, and he was a remarkable guy. He was a genuine leader. He was captain of South Africa under 19 rugby or whatever it was, or under 21s or whatever, but he was a captain. Yes. And he led the team from the front, and he was a really good guy. And when he came to Rhodesia, before I was involved with Farmers Winery, he used to take us on the most hair-raising adventures in around the pubs of Rhodesia.
Any stories you care to share, Dave, or are we not allowed to look into that history?
Well, the kind of thing that when we were touring in the eastern part of Rhodesia, and in the afternoon I phoned my wife and said, we'll be back for supper for sure. And that was on a Sunday.
Sure.
We got home on Tuesday morning.
Yo. An epic experience, it seems.
But, you know, as long as you were decent, phoned my wife and said that we're going to be late. It's not going to be supper, it'll be after supper. I didn't say it's going to be breakfast on Tuesday. And, you know, you've got to keep people informed and all. And it was just all part of an experience. So.
Dave, if we can, you mentioned Ronnie now, for example, and I think through these discussions, it's very clear that there are a lot of people that didn't always get a lot of the airtime, a lot of the, you know, media exposure. Are there people in your past, some names you'd like to mention that you think are also extremely important to remember within the South African industry of wine and spirits?
Well, certainly on the spirit side, there's nowadays a product called Stretton's Gin. And old man Stretton was an absolute wonder. He was a London-born gin distiller, and today there's a gin on the market called Stretton's Gin, which his son actually made. But he was just fabulous. He really, really understood the spirit business like I've seldom known other people. And then there was a guy called Gert Nievert at Farmers Winery, who was a wine buyer. I mean, if you talk about legend, you go out in the winelands, and especially to the co-ops, Gert Nievert was like a god. He really was. He had an understanding of the wine business like few other people had. And you know, we were buying wine in quantities like never ever been known before, to make Liebestein and Sonheimer and things like that. We were taking up like 30% of South Africa's wine and blending it and putting it into SFW labels, and it was just enormous. It just and you couldn't go anywhere else to see what other people had done because they hadn't been done.
Yeah.
And so guys like Gert Nievert and others like that were just way beyond their time. And the fact that they could think in those volumes, nowadays people don't think about it because it's already happened and has happened for a long time. But in those days, it was brand new. And tankers. I mean, every day you go out on the road, you see wine tankers. They didn't exist. And so we started making wine in these big volumes, and the wine was moved around in barrels. And they were loaded onto trucks, and then some bright guy came along and said, we should use a tanker to do that. And now you see tankers everywhere, and yeah, it's just part of the business. And there's stuff that we all just take for granted wasn't there before. And then all that wine had to be looked after chemically. People don't like the word chemical, but you had to look after it and make sure it all worked and all. And that's where Dampy had a brain that could get around those big volumes, because he went to study in California and they didn't make wine in those quantities. And so he learned from those guys, came back and put it to practice here, but they then came back here to see the volumes that we used to do. And and here, little old Stellenbosch.
No, you said you knew how to move volumes, well, KWV specifically knew how to move volumes, so quite prolific.
Yeah, well, KWV moved big volumes, but for export. They didn't put it into bottles and sell it locally, so they sold basically what South Africa couldn't sell, and they sent it to Europe in volume, and it was blended and bottled over there.
Yeah.
And then Farmers Winery got to the stage of doing it all locally. And in fact, KWE was a, I don't want to be negative, but they were a break on the development, because they were actually the government arm. And I think there were people in KWV didn't like to see that what they should have done earlier was now being done by somebody else, and especially a private company. So for a long time, KWV really didn't feature. But nowadays, thank goodness it does. And they make good wine nowadays.
Yeah.
And excuse me.
No, please go ahead. But Dave, on that note, it's a beautiful morning in Devon Valley in Stellenbosch. We are not sitting with a glass of wine. The plane hasn't gone over yet. But on the note of certain wines, you are a big fan of Tassenberg. Do you still drink it? Do you still enjoy your glass of Tass?
In my office there's a picture of a Tassenberg bottle being poured, and on the label is my face. And my daughter, who, as I said, was recently here, she said, when was that done? And I really don't remember. but it was done by some artist who, amongst a number of guys who drank Tussies like Dampy, that I used to drink Tussenberg because it's just a very good wine. And I still, I don't suppose a week goes by that I don't have a glass of Tussies. And give them their due, the modern guys who do it,
yeah,
make very good wine.
I'm going to go get a bottle this week, just to give it a taste. I drank a Chateau Libertas the other day for the first time in a long time. Used to drink a lot of that when I was at Stellenbosch, but not in a while. And it was such an enjoyable bottle of wine, and for the price you pay for it.
Exactly. Yes. God, I mean, and with the Tussies, people's expectations of wine are higher now than they used to be, and they expect better wine than we used to drink. But within this past week, maybe fortnight, we served Tussies to people out of a decanter, and they all raved about it.
Yeah, it just needs a moment to breathe.
Yeah.
You know, the younger wines, I hear, you should decant rather than the older wines. That's the mistake people make, apparently.
Oh, anyway.
That's what Marius tells me.
Yeah, but we poured this wine out of sight, not intentionally. It just, that's how it had worked out. And we poured it into a decanter.
Oh,
and
I think I see where this is going.
People raved about it. They wanted to see the bottle.
Oh.
We brought out screw top Tussenberg bottle. And there are still wine snobs who still, after having raved about it, they said, yeah, it wasn't really so good.
I need to backtrack a little bit. So on that note, what do you think about the concept of wine snobbery? Or am I using the wrong word? Because, I mean, I must say, I enjoy drinking beautiful, beautiful wines of South Africa and the world. But at some point, we need to recognize, I guess, that some of us are. We do get a bit snobbish about it.
Yeah, there's certain people who certainly won't mention names because they are very good at what they do. But they spoil it by being a snob at the end. And this wine that we served the other day, the Tussies, we served to one of those kinds of people. And a couple of minutes later, he was saying, oh, it really isn't so good. There's something in the aftertaste or something like that. And there are people who just can't accept that you've got to have something expensive.
Because I'm also thinking about the, you know, I want to call it the normal wine drinker. I think it might be the wrong word, but you might understand what I say, obviously. That you've got to think about the guy at home that's looking for a nice red at 80,
for sure.
80 to 100 rand, which is technically quite cheap in the market at the moment. Yeah, well, but yeah, it's a good find if you can find it.
We, Lorna's son from a previous marriage, he makes the taps for bag in the box. And his dad developed the fat tap that doesn't drip. So I don't know if you remember in the old days, there was always a little thing under the tap because
To rest in.
Yeah.
Yes.
And now it doesn't. And he makes those, and so he's had an insight to wine all his life. But when you go to his place on a Sunday and half the family is there, they drink. Well, you mentioned Chateau. They drink Chateau Libertas. And those kinds of wines, and they understand them, and they know whether they're good or not. Whereas there are lots of people who will drink much more expensive wine, but they don't know whether it's good or not. And those snobs that I have difficulty getting on with.
I apologize to the snobs. I am one too, Dave, I'm afraid.
No, I don't believe
we
it.
Really, really love, no. But it's good to, I think, drink diverse wine.
Absolutely.
Wines. So if you expose yourself to the low end and the high end every now and then
for
I think
sure.
It's all about balance, right? What is your favorite?
You did right. All about balance.
Yes.
Everything is balance makes, neither you are very good at balance, but it makes all the difference.
So what wines do you enjoy these days? I know it's very difficult to mention names because, you know. Well, you mentioned one guy, you've got to mention all of them, but are there some wines that you've really impressed with?
Yes.
The steadfastness maybe of a more traditional wine and then some of the newer guys coming out?
Well, one of the things that the lockdown, because the virus did, is it opened us up to drinking wines that we could get, which we wouldn't probably have otherwise done. And we've come across a couple of co-op wines. The names escape me now, but wines that we previously wouldn't have bought. Yeah. And we had a friend who bought a lot of this relatively inexpensive wine from the Swartland, and it's become a firm favorite of ours. And we drink that in fair quantities, and to the extent that when we heard that Mr. Ramaphosa was going to talk to us on Sunday, we immediately phoned this person and said, we need 10 cases in case he puts a lockdown on the wine again.
They received a boost from you guys. Yeah, nice.
And yeah, I forget where I was going, but there's a lot of wine which gets overlooked because it's not fashionable, but it's very good.
Yeah.
And in fact, nowadays, I don't think anybody goes to the expense of putting wine in a bottle that isn't good wine. There's just so much, those big containers that will take up the not so good wine. And having young Jesse Ruiz, who supplies the taps, he gets to see the stuff before it's being bottled or canned or whatever. And he often brings us stuff and shows it to us without us knowing what it is, and it's a damn nice wine.
Yeah.
And relatively inexpensive, make no error.
You just mentioned canned, so what's your opinion?
There was a time that I just thought putting wine in a can just wasn't an acceptable thing. But nowadays, the cans are just so good and they are lined that you don't get a tinny taste or whatever. And I've been on so many taste panels where there have been 10 wines on the table. You don't know what comes out of a can and what doesn't. And if the canning is done properly and the cans are lined properly, it doesn't look good. That's in people's minds, it doesn't look good. And and young Jesse Ruiz, a lot of times in the last year or so, has served us a wine that he's put into a decanter, but it started life in a can, and they were fun.
Dave, let's talk about some stories from the heyday of your career. I don't think it's, you know, probably can't say heyday because it's one of those careers that has just kept going, and you've written so much. We'll get to the writing and the research you did in the past as well, but I want to hear what happened to the wine swines and what you guys discussed and what solutions you came up with for South Africa and the South African wine industry. As I understand, you were a small group of people, and the only thing was that once a month, I think, one of you had to present a wine tasting and a dinner. I think it was also here at the Devon Valley Hotel that you that hosted you guys. So who was part of this exclusive club? And are there some interesting stories you'd like to share with us from that time?
Well, you know, I don't know what's interesting, but it started because when I became the production boss of Stellenbosch Farmers Winery here in Stellenbosch, I thought it's very strange that we don't know the opposition. Now, I'd worked in Germiston, I'd worked in Rhodesia, and everybody knew the opposition, and we all used to have a drink together on occasions. And so when I came to Stellenbosch, KWV wasn't spoken to by anybody. Distillers Corporation were there, but nobody really wanted to mix with them. Farmers Winery, those guys mixed with anybody. And so I got all the production heads, and I invited them to come and have a lunchtime drink here at Devon Valley Hotel. And I was sitting over there in the bar in Paul's Pub, and the expression on these guys' faces as they walked in, and they all knew each other, but didn't mix.
Yeah.
And so a guy from Distill came in, or distillers came in, the KWV guy came in, and they all saw each other, and they went to the bar. And eventually I said, well, we're actually, now you've met each other, we're going to have lunch together. And they were, they just never ever mixed before. And they discovered they both liked, or all liked wine, and they're this, and they spoke about rugby, and it was the start of what eventually became Wine Swans. And I didn't dream up the name. We had a guy who wasn't even in the wine industry, and we were beginning to meet fairly frequently, and he said, we need to have a name, and Wine Swans was the name, and it just grew out of that, and now we have guys who became members, and now their kids are members.
That's wonderful.
The Finlayson guys, their sons are members of Wine Swans. Jesse Ruiz is Lorna's son. He's a member of Wine Swans, and there are half a dozen others like that, and so. Because we got to the stage where a bunch of old guys, and you know, they're all going to fall over just now. And now there's a young bunch who carry on. And in fact, the people who run Wine Swans nowadays are all youngsters. And compared to Dampy, they're babies.
Poor Dampy. But it's interesting. So you basically played a kind of a conciliatory role between different parts of the industry, because, and maybe you can give your opinion on this as well. With this series, I've picked up from a lot of the guests that there isn't a lot of cohesion in the wine industry, and that people need to come together more in order to make it stronger. Do you agree with that, or do you think, well, it's a commercial entity and competition is competition? What is your opinion there?
Competition is good, but the friendship that wine and spirit develops shouldn't get lost in that competition. And there was a time when there was some kind of organization that people who were the workers, they were part of it, and then there were the bosses. And it was wrong. It just everybody was part of the business, but the bosses didn't want to mix with the workers and so on, and fortunately nowadays that seems to have disappeared, and everybody understands that you've got to have rules and regulations, and there's no point in having them if they're not obeyed. But if McDougall wants to do that, he must be free to do it, and I don't think today people are as bound to the way it should be, rather than the way that it is, and the way it's going to be better, and I don't think that's only in South Africa. I think that's the case all around now, and I think probably the French were doing that anyway, but now it's in Australia in particular, they also were like South Africa.
Yes.
There was that crowd and that crowd, but now it's a big mix of everybody.
Getting better.
Yeah.
Glad to see that. We are talking about the history of your career and of wine and spirits in South Africa. It is also Wineland's 90th birthday. Do you have a message for them and the role that they and as Vinpro have played in the past and in the industry?
As far as I'm concerned, that they're on the right track now, that we are all together, that there's not them and us. We're all together in this business, and if you want to survive and thrive, then you must all mix together and work together. And the days of the KWV being in control of everything, those are long gone. That nowadays it has to be a free enterprise, And heaven forbid that they ever go back to anything like that again.
Yeah.
No, the relations in the wine and spirit industry are good. And South Africa is not behind anybody. South Africa is up in the front and taking a leading role and everything, and which is good, because there was a time when we weren't. We were in the background all the time. And a lot of that had to do with our politics, and especially some of our racial stuff. I mean, nowadays, the fact nobody even thinks about a black guy joining you for lunch or whatever, and the knowledge of the black guy, it's not even a question.
Yeah.
They just are good or they're not. And if he doesn't play rugby and he plays soccer, that's free for him to do. And if he played rugby, he'd be better, but...
Sure, I tell you, Dave. Well, I mean, there was a time where we in the industry, when there was a new female winemaker, we would jump at the chance to interview that person. And that's not that we're not doing it at the moment. Yeah. It's just not something new anymore.
No. Yeah.
So we're thankful for that change in the industry as well. Let's talk about your career as a writer and as a researcher and historian. So it's one thing to be a distiller and to know a lot of wine and of spirits, but then to go and put it down with pen and paper is a completely different story. Where did your love for writing start?
Well, when I was only visiting South Africa occasionally and not living here, there was a magazine in Stellenbosch called Die Wynboer. And sorry, but I can't remember the guy's name at the moment, but I went to visit him and said, how come there isn't a book about winemaking? And he said, well, write one, you know.
Nobody's stopping you.
And Mr. Mayer on the corner of Dorp Street and Indringa, I think, somewhere there he lived, and he produced Wynboer. And so I wrote an article for him about how to read a hydrometer. In those days, every establishment that sold alcohol had to have a Sykes hydrometer, and the government guys would come in and check that you hadn't diluted the alcohol in the bottles and stuff, and you had to have an assized hydrometer for them to use. Typical government. You didn't provide their own stuff, so I wrote an article for him about how to use a Sykes hydrometer. And that was the first thing I'd ever written and ever had published and all. And he got calls from all over the show that they wanted more stuff like that. Just simple. It's how to read a hydrometer.
Did it just flow? Or was it a struggle process to write it?
I think it flowed. You know, my folks are Irish, and I think there's a bit of the Lorne comes through.
Oh, right, yes.
I don't think I ever had any hassle writing anything, but when I came to South Africa, a very, very good lady who worked for Stellenbosch Farmers Winery, she was very good in Afrikaans, but also with English. So I used to give everything before, having got into the business, I gave her everything before it got published to just edit.
Yeah, of course.
And she, I think, deserves a lot of the credit for what came out.
Because I'm looking at the titles and it's impressive. It's an impressive list. Living with Wine, contributed to John Platter's South African Wine Guide since 1996. You've done that. Brandies of the Cape, for example. Use on Booze. Love that title as well. So which do you think contributed most, or which of the publications are you the proudest of?
The big books I did with Phyllis Hands, I can't even think of their
Complete
name.
Book of South African Wine,
Those kind of things.
Wines and Brandies of the Cape of Good Hope.
Well, wines and brandies I did myself, but the other ones that I worked with Phyllis, those I think they were big publications and they sold very well and they really got your name going and mustn't ever forget Phyllis. Phyllis, she used to nag the hell out of me to get stuff done and everything. And she was a good person to have around and incredibly busy. She always was on a hustle and bustle and she's 90 now. And she's still like that.
Wonderful.
Oh,
Still
just.
always busy.
Oh.
New World of Wine from the Cape of Good Hope, the definitive guide to the South African wine industry. I think that was one you did with her as
Prob
well.
yeah, probably, I can't remember.
So, just in terms of the freedom of London, please, sir. So, I told you, sir, I said, sir, when I walked in, and we've met before. So, I know I can call you Dave. I know that's not your vibe to be called sir, but it feels like you should be called sir after having that. And I know it functions, you wear that token as well. So tell us about the freedom of London. Can you go wherever you want when you're there,
No.
or
The reason I wear that is if my photograph appears and I don't have it on, I
oh
get fined.
oh my word, are you kidding?
So
Or where is it now? I'm
there's
gonna
motivation, but I didn't think we'd be
yes
going in public and all. But I became a member of quite a number of British things, of the Guild of Distillers and a thing called the Keepers of the Quake that was a Scotch whiskey thing and all. And eventually I was given, it's a free man of London. It's not a freedom of the London.
A free man of London.
Freedom is if you're a
You've got the key to everything.
Free man, you don't pay tax, which is a
All right.
big
Okay.
thing. And for some guys that's a big boost that you can whatever you earn and the City of London doesn't. So being a free man of London gave me all kinds of perks. I could do this and do that and but if you went to a posh function and you didn't have your medal on, it cost you money. But if you lived in the UK, not paying tax in London was a big deal.
Yes,
You know, if you earned a lot of money and you didn't pay tax on it, it still is. Guys still look forward to doing that. Those guys have a car club of all old and great cars, and they all say that's a tax-free benefit.
Bargain.
They're able to keep the cars going.
The perk.
And it might not sound much, but if you're not paying tax in the City of London, that's a motivation to do what you should be doing.
I think if you're already not paying to enter a bathroom, you're already winning. It's the
Yeah.
first time I experienced that in my entire life many years ago. Wanted to go to the toilet in Harrods and I had to put down £2. It was crazy that time. But Dave, you are also someone who loved sports. So just a little bit stepping away from wine, you did the Comrades, I think they say it close to 10 times. I'm not exactly sure. Water polo, you loved doing as well. So tell us a bit about your love for doing sport on that level and things you enjoyed outside of wine.
When it comes to sports, I really enjoyed rugby. I loved rugby. I played as a 16-year-old. I played in the first league in Umtali in Rhodesia. So I was playing with guys that were well into the 20s and some in their 30s. So I played amongst some very good guys. So rugby is a very special sport for me. And my brother played rugby for Rhodesia. And when it was still Southern and Northern Rhodesia, he was playing on one wing and I was playing on the other wing, and I did a cross kick that he collected and scored. So it was a family business. I really enjoyed rugby. But and then got to the stage where couldn't play as much as I wanted to, and then I lived in a hotel for a while, and I got involved with Comrades, and began to run Comrades, and you know, it was easy. I'd kept fit all my life and all the rest of it, and then when I came to the Cape, I had no intention of ever running Comrades. When I came to the Cape, there were two guys at Farmers Winery, said, "We want to run Comrades. Can you help us train for the event?" And so I helped them, and they, in the end, didn't run Comrades, but I did. So I got myself fit and ran, and you know, being a relatively fit fellow, it was easy.
Yes,
I just did it, and then I ended up. I did five or six, and then I was traveling overseas a lot, and then somebody said, if you've done that many, you should do 10, and you get a special number if you do 10. So I did 10, and then after that, I spent too much time working overseas that I didn't train for Comrades. So. But I played other sports. I played water polo, you mentioned. I really enjoyed water polo, and rugby, hockey. Yeah, I enjoyed sport, and I enjoyed team sports.
Yes.
I really enjoyed that, and yeah.
In terms of your health today, Dave, how are you feeling, and how are you doing in your health at the moment? I'm hoping that very active lifestyle you led also helping today to keep you as fit as possible.
I think it helps in that. There's always the will to carry on and do something, but it also knocks me that I can't get up and run around and can't go anywhere without my walker. And used to be Johnny Walker, now it's just this walker. I don't have balance. That's a big problem, okay. I think. So. I tend to fall over, and of course everybody says he's had too much to drink, which might be right, but
oh well, that's their problem, I guess.
And I'm fit and well, and I live with this incredibly tolerant lady who puts up with all my nonsense.
A lovely lady.
No, she's good. She's
wonderful,
a
woman. It sounds
very
like
good, very good. And anybody who looks after animals in distress. Is a special place for them, and she, besides all those animals, she looks after me.
Thank you, Lorna, for being so kind. Dave, also, you are an honourable member of the Wine Masters, can I say club? Is it a club? I want to call it a club, Cape Wine Masters. Your role in the future and your wish for South African wine and spirits. If you have a message for the industry and your wish for the future?
Well, first of all, going back to being an honourable member, because I created the thing, I couldn't actually become a member. So they very kindly gave me membership. And I really believe that you need to have things like that to maintain the standards, and you can't always be fussy as who becomes a member like Dampy. I mean, you know, but you need to maintain standards, and in some cases set the standards. And sorry, what else did you say?
No, just your wish for the future.
Oh, for the future, that we continue to make as much good wine as we do. And especially in the spirit sites, because people tend to forget about spirits. That in some people's minds, it's not the right thing to do spirits, and wine is fine, but spirits is dangerous. And but there's a place for spirits, and it just mustn't be abused. And in fact, no alcohol should be abused. Doesn't matter what form it comes in, beer or Amarula or whatever. Alcohol is special, and you should treat it as such.
Thank you, Dave. What an honor.
Thank you.
And hopefully next time we sit around a table, it's with a glass of your favorite wine. But I think it's time for another cup of coffee. It's an icy morning in Stellenbosch. Thank you for taking the time to come and have a chat with me.
Absolutely.
A great honor to sit down with you. Finally, we've met so many times, so just have a long chat. Thank you very much.
In samewerking met Wineland Media, deel van die Winpro familie wat hierdie jaar ook hulle 90ste verjaarsdag vier.